visiting us. The students are here on a program called Court with Class. So they've had a little bit of information about the cases that your case that you're going to now argue to us. And my understanding is they will remain after this argument to talk with one of the justices. Is that correct? You're not sure? Okay. Well, Justice Daniel Kelly, who sits at the far end of the bench but is for whatever reason not apparent at this moment, will be out to talk with you at the conclusion of this case. Hold on just a minute.
He's Justice,
yeah, that's what I was just going to look. Is he a do not participate?
He is.
Is he?
Right.
Okay, good. Well, he still will be out. He was here for the first case this morning, and that's a good reminder to me and to us all that the bench will be six for the decision on this particular case without Justice Kelly. Now, someone also told me that, quote, Union Grove High School students were here. That's not on my list, but if that's correct, will they stand? Okay, all right, so perhaps they'll be here the next go-round. All right, so let me start now with calling the second case here. Toma versus the Village of Slinger, and you have a little bit of a different lineup here for time than we usually have, so let me go over it with you so that I'm sure we all are on the same page. Attorney Olson, you'll begin with 25 minutes. Then we will have 25 minutes by Attorney Cavish. Then we will have 5 minutes by Attorney Laubeyer. Say it again.
Dale Peterson.
I understand what he's saying. That's not what's on my list. Okay. All right. Very
my
good.
List.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And then a 5-minute rebuttal in with Eric Olson, correct?
Thank you.
All right. Very good. Are you prepared to begin?
Yes.
Please do.
May it please the court, it is a tremendous pleasure to be here, and a lot goes into preparing a case like this, as I'm sure the court knows. We have everybody here from our office in the front row and over there, and we have many students from the UW who have worked at the office for a while and are now going to law school, which may be something that the folks from the high school here can think about. That being said, let's get to the merits of this case. This is, at least at the beginning, was a fairly straightforward thing. The Tomas bought a farm, the Melia's farm, platted it into a subdivision. In 2007 and around that time, the streets and some of the improvements and part of it were put in, and some restrictive covenants were recorded, and a developer's agreement took place. In 2008, a lot sold. Then the economy crashed, as we all know. So, in that interim, the vast majority of the subdivision continued to be covered in hay and alfalfa. And at some point in 2011, the village of Slinger, which is where this was located, sued the developer, the Toma, asking for an injunction.
Right. And it was that injunction and the resultant order that it seemed to me created the context in which your client needed to provide the testimony in front of the Board of Review that he wasn't cultivating crops. In other words, that he was mindful of the injunction that the circuit court had ordered. However, he stuck very fast to the argument that he was engaged in agricultural use. And reviewing the transcript of that, the argument was based on maintaining ground cover. That's the phrase. You're shaking your head. No, you'll have a minute. Unless it's just a tick. I don't know. I'm sorry.
Nervousness, perhaps, Your Honor.
But, yeah. Well, the use, you're saying it all goes by use. We know that. And you're saying that the assessment follows the use, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. And so your client was arguing in front of the Board of Review that the use is agricultural, yes?
Yes.
Based on the maintenance of ground cover, yes?
Based on the agreement between us and the assessor that maintaining the ground cover constituted an agricultural
let's say
use.
For effect, let's say that we are not bound by what the assessor says, and we're looking for an actual legal reason to root our opinion in, okay? So, for a legal basis, as a legal basis for the notion that your client was using the land for assessment purposes as agricultural use.
Yes.
Without including in your response, because what the man's name escapes me, it doesn't matter for our purposes, that maintenance of ground cover constitutes agricultural use. If you can point me to a law that says that, I'd be grateful. So what is your pitch? What's your argument for why that is based in law?
The maintenance of the ground cover was the cultivation of hay and alfalfa. And in the case, for example, of Fee versus Board of Review, it was made clear that constitutes an agricultural use.
And our that is what he said at the Board of Review hearing, that it was hay and alfalfa?
We have part of the record before the Board of Review was removed by stipulation because it was not what was in fact before the Board of Review. But there was copious evidence before the Board of Review that it was hay and alfalfa.
As you know, just like I pointed you in the direction of the law before, I have to point you in the direction that we are bound by the parameters of the record here. So I'm asking you, sir, what does the record show? Because all I could find, and believe me, I've read it more than once, all I could find was a general reference to maintenance of ground cover. I could find no reference to his use of it for the production of or growing of hay and alfalfa. If you could point me to something in the record that says that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, we don't have the entire record because it wasn't preserved. We do have, for example, the chair of the board's judicial notice of what was happening on the property. Now, there may be a question whether a Board of Review as a quasi-judicial authority is capable
You're
of taking
talking about
review.
I think the chairperson, when she said, oh, boy, I used to drive by that property when they mowed hay, something to that effect, yes.
She said, I've driven by that property every year for 31 years because I see what's going on there, and she delivered the mail there, and she explained that they baled it, and they cut it, and they cultivated it. And furthermore, when we go to the question of judicial notice, one of the questions is whether a fact is subject to reasonable dispute, and I would submit to this court that it is not subject to reasonable dispute whether the property was being used for agricultural purposes and cultivated with hay and clover when sitting in the very file of this appellate court in this state was the affidavit of the village engineer and director of public works stating exactly that and with many photographs of the property covered in hay and alfalfa. So the fact of the matter is that this property was in agricultural use. You've
just said a bunch of things, and then you've drawn a conclusion that apparently is clear to you but is unclear to me.
Okay.
So far what I've heard you say, sir, that's in the record that I know of, is what the chair said in terms of driving past, delivering mail, observing the activities as you've described vis-a-vis hay.
I see.
What else is in the record to show that it fits within the legal definition of agricultural use, the production of for food or fiber, crops for the use of food or fiber?
Okay. Well, for example, at R84, page 70, we have a board member asking Mr. Grota, who is the assessor, are you saying that you feel that was being used as agriculture, not just ground cover maintenance. And Assessor Grota says, I believe that within Chapter Tax 18, which is what we should follow, as well as the guide put out by the Department of Revenue for use value, that it had previously met those two burdens, you know, to be assessed as agricultural. Then we have Mr. Toma and our side testifying that the use had not changed.
To be clear on that second point, Mr. Grota, the assessor, said, gee, it had always been used, and it had always been used for agricultural purposes in the past. So following my customary, the customary practice of assessing it based on use, therefore, because it's always been used for agricultural purposes, I have assessed it as agricultural. That's what you're that's, I think, the gist of what you're saying for point number, for fact number two.
Well, Mr. Grota testified that Mr. Grota, the assessor, whose assessment and classification are presumptively correct, testified that it had previously classified as agricultural use and met the burdens for agricultural use. Mr. Toma and Mr. Weiniger explained to the board that the use had not changed. Therefore, if it previously, by the admission of the assessor, classified as agricultural, and we have testimony in the record that the use did not change.
But when pressed, counsel, when pressed at the review hearing, as to what you, and you're doing the same thing.
Okay.
When pressed as to the exact nature of the use, what both the developer and the developer's counsel said after the developer had to leave for a funeral earlier than the proceedings ended, was that they over and over was the mantra, maintenance of ground cover. That's what Mr. Grota said constituted agricultural use. So if that's what you've got, I just want to make sure that I'm not missing anything. Is there anything else in the record to show what use was being made of the land?
Well, what we have in the record is we have Chair Grudzinski's judicial notice of what was going on. We have the assessor explaining what had happened in the previous years and that had classified as agricultural. We have the landowner and the landowner's attorney putting on evidence that the use had not changed. And we have the explanations at some length that the reason that the reclassification took place was because of a teleconference between village staff
and the Department of Revenue representative.
And that is perhaps not direct evidence, but I submit to this court that that would not have occurred and would have been unnecessary and entirely superfluous if the land would not have classified as agricultural without that.
Your point number three, that the land, that the use of the land had not changed.
Yes.
Okay. Do you agree with me or disagree that the record shows that when the board, members of the board pressed and asked specifically what was going on with the land, what they got was not the raising of hay and alfalfa. Now, I know you're going to run, okay, and you, if you want to stick with that line, then I'm going to stop.
Oh, okay, I'll
try to. If you want to stick with the line of, well, in previous years it had been used and they said it hadn't changed.
Okay.
But I'm going to actually take it to the reality of the situation.
Okay.
And the reality is when the developer and his counsel were asked precisely what was happening on the land, the specific activity they gave was maintenance. I can pull the record. I can pull the transcript. It's rife with the phrase, it's just maintenance of ground cover. It's just maintenance of ground cover. Mm-hmm. And finally it comes out from his lawyer, well, Grota told us that maintenance of ground cover constitutes agricultural use. So other than, was there a reason you just rolled your eyes at me?
No, Your Honor, because I think you make a good point, and I'm trying to listen very carefully to what you're saying so I can respond appropriately.
Okay, and so is there anything else in terms of the particular use the land was being put to?
Okay, that's a very good question. And obviously what it comes down to is, first of all, the background of how this comes into being, where the landowner goes to an open book and discusses the situation with the assessor, which admittedly is not in the record, and the two parties figure out what the agreement and disagreement is about. Now, obviously there was an injunction in this case, and we ultimately went in front of, the client ultimately went in front of the circuit court and had to explain why the client felt that he was not in violation of that injunction.
When you're done answering, Justice Gableman, I want to put a little place card holder in there based upon you're going.
Yeah,
let me know when you're done with the questions and answers.
Okay. And our position there was that there was a category of things that were agricultural use for tax purposes, and a smaller category of things that were prohibited under the injunction because they would be unsuitable on the subdivision in light of the zoning code and everything else that went on in the village of Slinger. We were ultimately unsuccessful in that, but that was the argument. And part of what goes on a subdivision when it is being made and maintained is that a nurse crop is planted, and that maintains the ground cover and makes sure that the soil stays in place and everything like that. This is not in the record, Your Honor, but that is where it sits, is that we had an argument in the other court going on.
Counsel, it's really better that you don't answer questions with information that's not in the record.
Okay, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah. Could I just maybe lead you in some questions that I have?
Yeah.
And they concern the injunction that you're referencing.
Okay.
How do we characterize something like an injunction or a different lawsuit on a contract or something? The Court of Appeals characterized it, I think, as a restrictive covenant. Is an injunction a restrictive covenant, or was the Court of Appeals referring to something other than the injunction when it said the subdivision is subject to a number of restrictive covenants, including one preventing the land from being used for agriculture? Talk to me about that a little bit, because I'm trying to find the place an injunction has in a determination of what the use of property is.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. And again, that's a little bit difficult to answer without going outside of the record, but there was an injunction in this case that I believe it's in the record that it arose out of a restrictive covenant. So that is out there. However, in Wisconsin, we have a system for the classification and taxation of real property that, at least for agricultural purposes, depends only on use. And we have that in our brief on various occasions. That's the Norquist case, that's Article 8, Section 1 of the Wisconsin Constitution, 70.32 of the statutes, Chapter Tax 18, and the manual all make it clear that agricultural classification is based only on use. Now, there are a vast arsenal of things that a village can do if it believes that a use is in violation of an injunction or a restrictive covenant, and that's exactly what the village did here. And hence that other case is ongoing, and it's been appealed, and there's a whole series of due process rights over there. But for the purposes of tax, the system works when the assessor goes out and classifies what's on the ground. And in fact, in this case, the assessor asserted to the Board of Review that normally the rule is that use trumps. However, because of this injunction, the assessor asserted to the board, and it made it into the minutes, which are part of the order of the board. We called the Department of Revenue that the assessor, along with village staff, he made a very strong statement that, and this is record 8458, pages 58-59, as Pat Janaski, the regional supervisor for the Department of Revenue, in charge of equalization in southeastern Wisconsin, rendered that opinion in a conference call with both myself and village officials, which had to the question of use and what the assessor's responsibility should be in assessing these properties. So with that confirmation and with the court order for 2014, the property, in my opinion, should be at market value.
Counsel, can a restrictive covenant / injunction impact classification?
Not for agricultural purposes, Your Honor. I think that's clear under the Norquist case. I think that's clear under all the authorities that I just said. The use is the use, and the use goes off what's on the land. The injunction may go to the person, and there may be all sorts of consequences if it's later found out that it's not followed. But the assessor's job is to go out and make sure that the land is classified based on the use.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, the question that was asked by Justice Ziegler, in part, as I understood it, discussed both the restrictive covenants and the injunction. Now, those are two distinct things, are they not?
Very true, Your Honor.
And when were the restrictive covenants, give me the history, when were the restrictive covenants, when did they come into play vis-a-vis Mr. Toma and the property?
They were put into place sometime around 2007 or perhaps early 2008 as part of the development process.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so, and those restrictive covenants, one of the restrictive covenants imposed as part of the development, you can develop it, but you can't use it for farming. That was one of the restrictive covenants that was put into place. Is that correct or am I incorrect?
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor,
okay.
But that's not in the record.
Okay. Well, let's look at page 181, appendix 155. Now, there may be other places. This just happens to be what I pulled up quickly. And there, I think on 155, Mr. Toma is explaining what are his problems, what are the genesis of his problems, why are he's having problems in selling the real estate.
Mm-hmm.
And in 155, he says, well, the restrictive covenants, that is on the property here, I think they're a major thing. You know, it's a problem for anyone building on this subdivision. We want to do away with them, but we're not able to do that right now. Question, and can you explain to the board a little bit about the lawsuit that's pending and how you think that affects the value of the, well, we're in a lawsuit right now with the subdivision, etc. And so the lawsuit came much after the restrictive covenants. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, Your
Honor. And the injunction came how many years after the restrictive covenants were imposed?
Perhaps 5 years.
Okay.
Well, the injunction is the separate lawsuit that we're talking about. So all we need to know is that there was an injunction against the developer. Correct?
There was an injunction, Your Honor, and the exact meaning of that injunction is in question and is on appeal in another case.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, we have the Court of Appeals decision here in the appendix.
Mm-hmm.
And paragraph 1 says of the Court of Appeals, subdivision is subject to a number of restrictive covenants, including one preventing the land from being used for agriculture. Is that true? I mean, one of the things in looking at the Court of Appeals decision, which we are looking to see if we should affirm it or not, right, is whether there are any errors here of fact or law. So there's one
covenant, it says, that prevents it the land from being used for agriculture. In 2012, as part of the village suit to enforce the covenants, a court entered an order prohibiting the properties from being used for agriculture. Is that true?
It is true that that injunction was entered like that. It's disputed whether the restrictive covenant actually prohibits the land from being used for agriculture, hence the appeal, and it's disputed what the meaning of agriculture in the injunction is. And I would note that the injunction itself was not in the record before the Board of Review. And furthermore, at the time that the Court of Appeals wrote this decision, the Court of Appeals stated that and this is at paragraph 12 of the Court of Appeals, thus, Toma is really arguing that illegal use in defiance of a court order would still entitle him to an agricultural classification. That is not at all what we're arguing, and never has been. We have argued that there is a way to obey the injunction and also a way to do a use that classifies as agricultural under the tax code because of issues that are not in the record in this case. But that has been our argument. We've held fast to that. We're appealing the other case, and we've looked for interlocutory review, I think, at least twice. So this is certainly not a case, with all due respect, court orders are a very important thing. They must be obeyed. But at the same time, we have our due process rights to take the position, at least, that it is possible to obey the court order and also to qualify for ag use in a specific way. And we've been working very hard to vindicate those rights.
Well, I don't think anybody is disputing that, counsel. I mean, okay. Right now, the issue as I see it is what is the proper assessment for this property? That's the issue in front of this court. And that is why it was with some frustration that I reviewed the record, and it's some frustration, obviously, that I was listening to your responses, but I understand if there is material information outside of the record that perhaps you have some frustration, too, based on what you've just said. But just so the proper frame is placed, the issue, as I see, excuse me, the issue, I'm getting all choked up over this case.
It'll be okay, Mike.
I agree, it will be. The issue for us is the classification of the assessment. Mm-hmm. And so you know as well as I do what the issue is or what the facts have to show in order for you to do that. I'm very well aware that the use trumping ordinances even is the assessor's role. So it's not just it's injunctions, it's court orders, it's ordinances, but that's not before us. So,
thank you.
Okay. Well, my light is red. May I say one very brief thing?
You can talk in rebuttal. You have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You've saved. Right. We'll now proceed to the village.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Kabush, and I represent the village of Slinger. This is a certiorari review of the Board of Review's property tax assessment decision classifying 62 vacant residential lots owned by Mr. Toma as residential. The court's job is to review the evidence that was presented before the Board of Review to determine if there's any reasonable evidence to support the board's decision. For property tax classification purposes, agricultural land is defined as land devoted primarily to agricultural use. Mr. Toma needed to present to the board evidence that these lots were being used primarily for an agricultural use. Mr. Toma and his attorney repeatedly stated to the board at the hearing that he was not farming the land. This statement that I'm not farming the land ends the review. He wasn't devoting the land primarily to an agricultural use.
I'm not sure it ends the review because they were taking the position, as I went over with your opposing counsel, They were taking the position that the maintenance of ground cover constituted agricultural use. And I searched the record, and I'm searching the law, and I'm asking now for any kind of legal basis besides the opinion of Mr. Grota, the assessor, as to how that could possibly be true.
I agree. Mr. Toma, in response to a specific question from a board member, the question actually was, and it's on appendix page 165, so even though it was assessed as agricultural in 2013, you weren't actually farming it. Mr. Toma's answer, we were just maintaining the ground cover. Mr. Toma never explained to the board what maintaining ground cover involved and how maintaining ground cover constituted primarily devoting this land to agricultural use. He never explained that.
Didn't it come out later, though, in the as a more, perhaps not an explanation, but a more fuller context of that response, because it did not seem to me an intuitive response. It's not what I would expect as far as a response to how does it qualify as agricultural. I'm maintaining ground cover. But the explanation is that Mr. Grota told them, and I don't know if it's true or not. I don't know if it's true that Mr. Grota said it, but I think I recall Grota testifying that, yes, he did take that position at some point, even though his testimony was a little difficult to follow, that, yes, maintenance of ground cover constitutes agricultural use.
I don't agree that Mr. Grota said maintenance of ground cover constitutes agricultural use. I believe Mr. Grota said in response to a question from a board member that past use was agricultural, and he changed the classification based upon the court order in the other case after he talked to the Department of Revenue. I believe that's what his testimony
right,
was.
The DOR.
Yes.
Representative, yes. The other question that's called to mind, and this is where I thought I was going to get to go under previous question, the other question that is called to my mind here is, okay, say we see it your way, and there's not enough in the record to show that it was being put to agricultural use. I'm not sure, and I'm asking your help on this, I'm not sure that that automatically means it's residential, because as I'm reading this and reviewing it, it's like, all right, I don't see any evidence that there were crops being grown for food or fiber on this land, but you know what also isn't on this land is any residences. And so I look to the definition of what constitutes residential use in 73.2 sub 2, and it's a non-exclusive definition, 70.32 sub 2 sub small c part 3. Residential includes any parcel or part of a parcel of untilled land that is not suitable for the production of row crops on which a dwelling or other form of human abode is located, and which is not otherwise classified under this subsection. Believe me, I had to read that more than twice, too. But what it seemed to describe, last week when I was preparing for this, what it seemed to me to describe was when you say the word subdivision and the typical house in a subdivision, that's what that seems to describe. And, well, okay, I could be wrong, but that's when I parsed it out, that's what it seemed to me to describe. So help me out as to why, if I don't buy the argument that the land was being put to agricultural use under the facts as they exist on this record, why must I buy the argument that it's being put to residential use?
Yes, thank you. Your Honor, if we look at 70.32 subsection 2A, there's seven classification categories that the land can be classified under. First one's residential, second commercial, third manufacturing, fourth agricultural, fifth undeveloped, 5M is agricultural forest, 6 productive forest land, 7 other. Based on the evidence before the Board of Review, I would submit to you that if this isn't agricultural, the only other classification that can possibly apply is residential. They had before them a large amount of evidence that this was a The purpose for this land was to be developed as a subdivision.
It's zoned that way. That was the purpose of the initial agreement, as Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's questioning flushed out. That was the genesis of the restrictive covenant that then apparently led to an injunction. At least that's the flavor of the record. And then there's some evidence that there's infrastructure put in. There's curbs, I think, some sewer. I can't remember what else as far as indicia, but it's on the record. But I'm thinking to myself, there are no houses.
Correct. I think that the record shows there's one or maybe two houses on the lots. But also,
There are houses there?
I think in the record you'll see Mr. Toma testified that he actually had one spec house put up on a lot.
Okay.
And I think there was one other house mentioned in Mr. Toma's testimony in the transcript of the board hearing.
And are those parcels that the resident, that the abodes, as the statute calls them, are those part of the 62 acres?
Yes. Yes. And also, Your Honor, I would refer the court to the Wisconsin Property Assessment Manual, Chapter 8. That's the residential section of the Wisconsin Property Assessment Manual, and it specifically sets out a series of questions to answer as to whether vacant lots should be classified as residential. And the first question is, are the actions of the owner consistent with an intent for residential use? And I would submit in this case the answer to that is yes. Mr. Toma developed this land as a residential subdivision. He was offering the lots for sale as residential lots. He installed improvements, as we talked about, such as roads and sewer, and he had the property rezoned from agricultural to residential. So clearly his intent is to use this property as a residential property.
But we're left with the fundamental principle that it's use that trumps everything else. And it seems to me that it's very, very difficult here. Obviously, the presence, and you're right, my recollection now is, in my dim mists of memory, are that there were one or two houses. So I agree with that. But the bulk of the land, someone's intent, and even their zoning doesn't necessarily answer the question of what use it's be. Right now, the use seems to be, we're trying our best to sell this as residential property, but it is tough out there. Okay?
Right.
That's what it seems to me the use of this land is.
I agree. He was trying to sell it as residential property. Single-family residences is what it was for sale for, so his use was residential.
You're focusing on that. I'm focusing on try.
Right, and clearly the economy affected that for a period of time. I agree. But the purpose, and I believe Mr. Peterson is going to speak to this on behalf of the Farm Bureau, the whole purpose of the agricultural use classification was to preserve farmland. And what this developer is doing is just the opposite of the purpose of this legislation. So the developer had to come in with evidence of actual use before the Board of Review, because that's what this court is looking at, is the evidence before the Board of Review. And when he says, I'm not farming it, I'm only maintaining the ground cover for aesthetic reasons so I can sell these lots, I would suggest that's not primarily devoting the land to agricultural use. And he doesn't get that classification.
This development was set up in three sections, and you couldn't develop 2 and 3 until you had developed 1 sufficiently, correct?
Correct.
Should we consider each section's use independently, or do we consider them all together, as apparently you're arguing?
Yeah, and Your Honor, at the board, they had a discussion about that at the beginning of the hearing, how they were going to handle all of these lots, because there were so many, and they ultimately seemed to default to, we're just going to talk about them all as one group. But the bottom line is Mr. Toma didn't present any evidence to the board that he was doing anything different in phase 2 or 3 than he was doing in phase 1.
But there are restrictions on development that the village put in place, right? Unless
misunderstand
the record.
That the village and the developer agreed to.
Okay, well, it doesn't matter.
Well,
what lies on the land, and what I'm trying to figure out as I'm looking at all of this is whether we should consider that as we determine whether We look at the whole chunk and say, if the whole chunk isn't agricultural, you're done. Or do we look at it and say, well, there were two houses on the first section of development, so that may be something that needs to go back to the board to determine there was nothing on the other two sections, nor could there be.
Yeah, I don't think it matters what was on the other two sections, is how he was using the land.
Well, yeah, but he couldn't use it for development. That's unless I misunderstand the record.
Well, I guess I disagree with that statement.
Okay,
he could use it. He was using it for develop. He had developed it. He had entered into a developer's agreement. He had.
But he could not put residential homes on two of the three parcels or sections of this development, correct?
Yeah, at least phase two. He had to sell at least 50%, I think, of the lots of phase one.
Before he could move to phase two.
Right.
Okay, that's all I'm trying to get
straight.
Council, what
you don't think that makes any difference?
I don't think it makes any difference based upon the record before the Board of Review.
When I listen to your words, I hear you saying use is the only basis upon which property can be classified and thus taxed. Is that correct?
Actual use is what determines the classification. That's correct.
And what I hear you saying is they failed to meet their burden that this was used for agricultural purposes.
Correct.
So what place does the injunction / restrictive covenant have in the assessor's opinion?
It should have no place. It's a whole separate lawsuit. I think the injunction could play a role in determining what evidence of use was, because I don't think if the board's told there's an injunction that prohibits agricultural use, I don't think they should assume that somebody's violating a court order or an injunction. I think it can be evidence of actual use, but I agree that the injunction can't trump actual use. I agree with that statement. But the injunction could be, I think the Court of Appeals said the injunction could be evidence of actual use. So Mr. Toma, if he was actually farming the land or using the land for some agricultural purpose, he could have come before the Board of Review and said, hey, I'm challenging the injunction in the other case. I disagree with it. I have that up on appeal. And in the meantime, I'm farming this land. I've leased it to a farmer. We're growing, whatever he was doing, he could have presented that to
the board. The reason I smile is because your response flushes out my impression of this case. It's like a divorce. There's one side, there's the other side, and there's the truth. The truth as I see it here is that the bulk of, this is a developer who's having a very tough time selling the land for the purpose that he bought, which is to turn it into residential subdivision. And he's spent, presumably, a lot of money on infrastructure. And the reality of it is there's a lot of that, and this goes to the Chief Justice's question about the different phases and the different sections of the land. Okay, you've got two houses. But other than that, you've got 62 acres of nothing. And so one of the things that I'm wrestling with is what was the legislative intent, as expressed through the statutes, for someone who there are no crops on the land. I'm not saying this as if I'm making a finding as a matter, but my understanding of the record is there's nothing on the land that would qualify as a legal crop, food or fiber. But there's, besides those two houses, there's nothing that qualifies as a human abode. And so what do we do with all of that land? You said, your first answer to me was, when we look at the seven classifications, the one it comes closest to is residential. Let's say I agree with you, but still, should we be making room for reality here somehow, and how to do that under the statute?
Sure, Your Honor. And actually, I think Mr. Peterson may speak to this more than I am, because he is going to speak to the legislative history and purpose of the legislation. But as I understand it, the purpose of the legislation is to prevent exactly what happened here, and that's converting farmland into residential developments like this. And therefore, absent actual evidence of farming, which we have not in this record, he doesn't meet the criteria or the purpose of the legislation.
And that brings us back to what Justice Ziegler was asking about and what you started your presentation with by properly pointing our attention in the direction of this as being here on certiorari review and our limited role in terms of making the determinations as to whether the operative board kept within its jurisdiction, made a finding of fact that a reasonable fact finder, and so that seems to be you're consistent in that assessment.
That is my position. This is a certiorari review. We have to review the record before the board, and we're looking for any evidence in the record to support the board's decision. I think that is the standard of review on certiorari.
And
so,
what is the standard? Even though I've been dealing with it in one form or another for almost 25 years, what is the burden that your opposing counsel would have to show to demonstrate that the board of review got their fact wrong?
He would have had to show, he would have had to present evidence that he was actually using land for an agricultural purpose. He would have had to show that the assessment was wrong. He would have had to convince the board
of
that.
To what requisite degree that a reviewing court would find?
Well, the reviewing court, as I understand the reviewing court looks at what was the board's decision and is there any reasonable evidence in the record to support that decision.
You also have to look at whether the board stayed within the law, correct? And
that's
what's being argued by opposing counsel is that the board did not follow 70.32 because 70.32 trumps everything, correct? That's what they're arguing. I know the Court of Appeals presumed the board, according to their opinion, stayed within the law. But as we review it, we don't presume that. We look at whether they did or not.
I think that the case law suggests we do presume the board's decision is correct.
But we have the four standards of certiorari review that we have to look at before we come to any conclusion,
yeah.
Correct?
And the second one is according to law, and I agree.
Right.
I think that's
right.
The issue they're trying to raise in this case, and I would suggest that this board acted according to the law based on the evidence before it. There was no other classification that they could come to other than residential based on the evidence before
right.
them.
Right, correct.
Is zoning different than classification?
Yep. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
My law clerk,
and
oh, I'm sorry.
If the property is originally classified agricultural, do you start with that should the assessor first start with this is agricultural and they need to prove it isn't agricultural?
Well, my understanding is the assessor is supposed to review the land and make his determination based upon his review of the land. So just because it was agricultural at one point in time doesn't mean in the next year it's still being used as for an agricultural purpose. So the assessor has to make that initial decision based upon his actual review of the land.
He did say the use hadn't. No, it was Mr. Thomas said that the use had not changed. Correct.
Let's look at the issues of law. Justice Gableman mentioned some frustration, and I too share some frustration in this case because the two parties disagree what the issue is, you disagree what the record is, and I just wonder what we're doing here in part. The issue, as stated, as summarized in the petition for review, ended, stated more simply, does an injunction trump use? That's the issue. Is anyone arguing here that injunction trumps use?
No.
Did anyone argue in the Court of Appeals that injunction trumps use?
We did not.
Let me get a little deeper into the issue of law. If no one is arguing that injunction trumps use, I take it that you're not arguing it because you don't think that's a correct statement of the law. but it is apparently what the assessor relied on. So you have that testimony that that's what the assessor relied on. What other part of the record did the three-member board rely on in order to come to its decision? Stated another way, what's the basis of the decision of the three-member board that we are reviewing?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would submit the whole record. Mr. Thomas started out his presentation talking about the history of the land and how he was using the land and how he developed it. Also, his specific statement more than one time that he was not farming the land. I mean, that right there is a statement that I'm not using it for an agricultural use. And then the follow-up several times by his attorney and himself that all he was doing was maintaining the ground cover. And his attorney said, in direct answer to a board member, he's maintaining the ground cover so he can sell the lots. So he's maintaining the ground cover for aesthetic reasons, to keep it looking good, so he can sell the lots for residential, single-family residences. So I think that evidence right there alone is reasonable evidence to support the board's decision.
Well, let's take a look at the board's decision. 203 and 4, and part of 205 in the appendix have what the board decided. There was a motion made by the chair to have it as agricultural use in favor of Mr. Thoma. That didn't get a second. So this is what the 2-1 decision of the board was. Then there was a motion by board member Martin, and I'm paraphrasing, as we were instructed to presume the assessor is correct, we go with what Grote's assessment has done, making it a residential assessment. So the attorney for the board gave instructions a bit on the law. Then you have I'll second that, seeing I don't see that Mr. Thomas has met his burden of proof because his sales, he didn't bring any documentation, and if he had, those wouldn't have been arm-length sales. That goes to the evaluation. But more importantly, going down a line or two, I won't go down. Whether it should be agriculture, whether they're using it agricultural or maintaining ground. Maintaining ground, as I understand today, would also lead it to be residentially taxed or assessed. So I second the motion. They voted on it, and that motion passed. So it seemed to me that what the motion initially started out as presumption of correctness that we all, that you now think is an incorrect basis, and then you have no evidence and maintaining the ground is not farming.
Well, I agree that the assessor's reason was incorrect, but he got the classification correct, residential. I believe this board member is saying, the way I read this is agricultural or maintaining ground cover. And this board member is saying maintaining ground cover, as I understand it, is to lead to a residential tax. I think the board member understood that if Mr. Thoma is coming in and saying, all I'm doing is maintaining ground cover to sell these lots, then that's not an agricultural use.
Yeah.
That's the way I understand it.
But his more full explanation, or the explanation offered by the attorney after Mr. Thoma had left, was based on Mr. Grota. I mean, so there was more to it than that. Mr. Grota had represented, according to what the attorney said, Mr. Grota had represented that maintaining ground cover constituted agricultural use. It doesn't matter. I can look. But one question I do have is, my law clerk pulled for me the most recent copy of the Property Assessment Appeal Guide for Wisconsin Real Property Owners from the Department of Revenue. And it's very similar to one of the considerations that you discussed into how the assessor is to determine whether the land is being used for residential purposes. Vacant land where the most likely use would be for residential development. Obviously, kind of right on the nose here. But my question is, and if anybody happens to know, I'd be interested in hearing, what is the legal authority for the Department of Revenue to set that as a binding standard such that we would apply it as a principle of law, that even though there's nothing on it, there's nothing on it but my impression, well, there's nothing on it in terms of legal crops and a hope and a wish and an effort to sell it as residential lots. Do you know?
Can I give a short answer?
Yes. First of all, I don't understand your question. You may answer it, but would you rephrase it?
Because sure.
I don't know exactly what you're asking.
The DOR put out, the Department of Revenue put out a property assessment appeal guide for Wisconsin real property owners.
Okay.
And one of the criteria they set forward in that for owners to help them determine whether their use of land is in fact residential is if the land is vacant, but the most likely use would be for residential development. And so, okay, so that sounds like it would fit with the fact pattern that we have here, except for I'm not sure, I cannot find the legal nexus between this handbook or this appeal guide put out, published by the Department of Revenue, and something ground in case law or statute. So I don't know what weight.
Okay, so you're asking him to connect
it
up for you.
If he knows,
okay,
yes.
Good. Now I understand, and you certainly may answer.
I will try. I don't know if what you're looking at is part of the Wisconsin Property Assessment Manual, but I can say, and I can't give you specifics.
It's called the Property Assessment Appeal Guide for Wisconsin Real Property Owners.
I got to tell you, I'm not specifically familiar with that, but I am familiar with the Wisconsin Property Assessment Manual, and I do believe that the legislature has charged the Department of Revenue with putting out a property assessment manual to guide assessors and residents on how to apply this legislation.
I found that much, but yeah. I couldn't find the specific nexus of law.
I mean, if the court asks, we'd be happy to look into that further, but I don't know the answer to that right now. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you very much. Attorney Strong.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Well, as you begin, yours was the first brief I've seen since I've come to this court that says, hey, folks, you should send this back. You shouldn't have granted it to begin with. That was the interesting
problem. Let's hear the argument.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much, and it pleases the court. My name is Dale Peterson, and I represent the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation, and we support the decision of the Board of Review that denied agricultural classification on this property, and we believe that the decision of the trial court and the Court of Appeals was correct in affirming that decision. 16 years ago, I had the privilege of appearing before this court on behalf of the Farm Bureau and 12 other statewide agricultural groups defending the constitutionality of our use value assessment statute. And in that case, in 2002, the Norquist case that Attorney Olson referred to, the Supreme Court, you upheld the constitutionality of that statute on the same date in the companion case that we were involved in, the Mallow case. You also upheld the Department of Revenue's accelerated implementation of use value assessment. We're participating in this case because we believe that the developer's legal position and the arguments that are being made undermine the integrity of use value assessment as enacted in the by the legislature and are contrary to the legislative intent when that statute was enacted. Use value assessment was enacted by the legislature in 1995, and the express statutory purpose is to preserve Wisconsin's farmland and to reduce its conversion to other purposes. The statistics that we have in our brief obtained from the Department of Agriculture show that the law has been very effective. Before the full implementation of use value assessment, Wisconsin was losing agricultural land at the rate of about 29,000 acres per year. And in the last four reported years, the statistics available indicate that we're losing farmland at the rate of about 3,000 acres per year. And so I think that proves the legislature's wisdom in enacting it, and also the correctness of this court's decision in upholding it.
Might be reflective of the high price of farmland.
That could be. There would be those factors.
Counsel, but I want you to make sure you have enough time in your 5 minutes
right.
to address the issue of why you think we should improvidently grant this, because it concerns me if no one's arguing the issue for which we took it, what should we do about that? But you may not be there yet.
Well,
I want to.
Justice Bradley, we took that position because it was what was identified during the argument, indicating the petition framed the issue as everybody agrees it was agricultural land and it lost that classification because of the injunction. We disagree. That is a mischaracterization of what the issue is. There wasn't agreement that this was agricultural land that would have been entitled to that classification but for the injunction. We think because of the misstatement of the issue would be the reason why this court could consider dismissing.
You want to make sure that it's use that is the consideration.
Exactly. The use values statute indicates that agricultural land means land devoted primarily to agricultural use.
Right.
And agricultural use is then further defined as land as defined specifically by the Department of Revenue as devoted to agriculture using agronomic principles. Now, the Department of Revenue has come out with the rules to implement this. It's set forth in Wisconsin Administrative Code 18.05 that define what agricultural use is. And maintaining ground cover, mowing the vegetation to maintain ground cover is not an agricultural use under the rules of the Department of Revenue, Administrative Code 18.05. Those rules from the Department of Revenue reference also the NAICS classification.
Counsel, which section, because I have 1805 before me, are you relying when you say that the rule says that mowing ground cover, here they mowed it and they baled it, but is not agricultural use. What subsection are you relying on?
It indicates what is agricultural use, and I'm saying to you, based upon that rule and the adoption of NAICS subsection 111, mowing grass to maintain ground cover is not an agricultural use.
But that is not set out in 18.05.
Correct. It does not indicate
okay, then
that.
I misunderstood you because I thought that's what you
You're
said.
Saying it's the absence of
correct.
That.
If I conveyed that, I was wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that there is nothing in the administrative code rules that would allow mowing grass to maintain ground cover to be an agricultural use. It doesn't fit the rules also in there. What I want to be clear about is the law is very clear, and I don't think there's any disagreement that use is the exclusive controlling factor for eligibility. It doesn't matter about zoning. It doesn't matter about ordinance. It doesn't matter about deed restrictions. It doesn't matter about platting. It doesn't matter about lot size. It doesn't matter how much income you derive. It doesn't matter contract provisions, and it doesn't matter if you're violating an injunction. Use only controls eligibility.
Thank you.
We ended up here, we believe, because there was a complete failure of proof before the Board of Review.
Why
Thank you.
Do you want
His red to... light is on.
I know, but it's a question of whether other people get a chance to ask some questions. Why do you want it dismissed and just not affirmed?
Because we believe that there is no dispute about the legal principles in the controlling law. Use only controls. There's no dispute among any of the parties or the other amicus, and it's clear from the Wisconsin Revenue Assessment Manual that that's the only factor that controls. And because of that, we believe that this case could be disposed of by dismissal of the petition.
Well, that leaves the Court of Appeals decision in effect.
That's correct. And the Court of Appeals ruled the way it did because it found that there was a failure of the landowner to meet his burden of proof. And if I could make one more statement. If a landowner is contesting an assessment and they appear, they have to overcome the prima facie assumption that the assessment is correct. So if the landowner appears and puts no proof in, and if the municipality appears and puts no evidence in, the landowner is going to lose because they failed to meet their burden of proof to overcome that prima facie presumption.
Thank you, Councilor.
Thank you.
This court in the Sausen case, made it very clear that the review of a certiorari review reviews the decision of the Board of Review, not the decisions of the Circuit Court or the Court of Appeals. That's paragraph 5.
No, but the Court of Appeals and the Circuit Court affirmed. So if we dismissed it, as Attorney Trout is saying to us we should do, then the Board of Review's decision stands.
True.
Correct? Same thing.
True. But what I'm getting to is, what did the Board of Review say? The Board of Review very clearly said in its order, which was in its minutes, which were incorporated in its findings of fact, determinations, and decision, board members asked Assessor Grota if it was his opinion that maintaining the ground cover on this property qualified as agricultural use. Assessor Grota stated it was his opinion that this activity fulfills the criteria for agricultural use, but the court order changes the priorities to be considered for assessment.
Now, that I believe, when I read that, that's from the minutes, I think. That was not from a transcript of his testimony. That was somebody recording a summary of what he said.
That was from the minutes, Your Honor. But if you look at Record 29-3, which is the findings of fact, determination, and decision of the Board of Review, as the form is filled out, it says, see attached minutes. And it attached the minutes. And our understanding of that was, and our position in this case, is that these minutes are the findings of fact, determination, and decision of the Board of Review, because otherwise the form isn't filled out.
But we're not bound by, we now end where you and I began. We're not bound by Mr. Grota's understanding of what the law is. And that's why I started by offering you several times the opportunity to point me to some law that would support Mr. Grota's position.
Well, Your Honor, I will just say, and I've tried to answer your question. I'm really not trying to give a runaround here, but it's a frustrating case because before the Board of Review, our understanding, and from the minutes and from the record, I think it's clear, is that there was not a dispute about whether the use would have classified as agricultural or not in the absence of the court order. And so
in the absence of what?
In the absence of the court order, we did not understand that there was a dispute about whether or not the use classified as agricultural. The question was, what effect does the court order have on it? And hence all the testimony about the court order and everything else. So we took that as having the effect of an admission, as though the assessor had admitted, yes, the ground cover classifies as ag. Hence, that is prima facie correct. And then farming and ag is not...
I'd be willing to see it more your way if that's the way the transcript read. It seemed to me that the responses were trying to thread a needle of saying, we're not in violation of that injunction, so we're not engaged in the growing of crops. because that would violate the restrictive covenant, which formed the basis of the injunction. However, what we are doing is we're maintaining the ground cover, which the assessor, Grota, told us does constitute agricultural use. That is the needle that I saw Mr. Thoma's case resting on, and that's why I led with the line of questioning that I led with. And I wonder, this brings me back to a larger point, which is, I wonder why you're not just asking us to clarify the law here or something where there's land is being held for residential purposes. And that's why I wanted to know if there was an actual legal support for the Department of Revenue handbook, which they published. If there is, that's one thing. If there's not, maybe why not ask for an interpretation or a clarification that says when it's zoned this way, the use still trumps, but the court has to recognize reality. There are no crops that meet the legal definition of crops. There are two, apparently there are two places that meet the legal definition of human abodes, but there's a whole vast area of land that's costing a lot of money to hold nothing. And so that to me seems something to think about, as opposed to the absence of the law that would, you got a tough row to hoe on certiorari review, as you know.
Your Honor, that the record, to be perfectly honest, is why I rolled my eyes when you gave that question, because it is very difficult to understand what the record says with the people speaking over each other. And I grant you, it's difficult to see, looking strictly at the record, where would be the proof of agricultural use. I agree. And that's a very frustrating part of this case. However, I submit that the minutes, which became part of the findings of fact and order of the board, are very good evidence of what everybody who was there that day understood. And what that evidence, I submit, shows is that there was essentially an agreement between the assessor and the property owner that, yes, this classifies as ag. And we would not typically be expected to put on a lot of evidence or even any evidence about a fact or a condition that was essentially stipulated to by the other side, particularly when that side's stipulation or assertion or admission bore along with it a guarantee of prima facie correctness. So if in this state we suddenly start proving the things that we agree on, it becomes a much more laborious process to do anything. And I understand, Your Honor, your extreme frustration with the state of the record. I share it 100%, having looked through this. The reason we brought this here, the reason this review was not improvidently granted, is that the Board of Review ruled on the idea that the injunction overrides the use trumps rule. That came in through hearsay that was proffered through an expert, but it came through with a great deal of reliability because it was based on a conference call that had happened with village officials and all this, and the board listened to that, and there's a part of the record where the board member even asks Assessor Grota, you're telling us that we have to go residential no matter how it was used, and Assessor Grota says, correct. And there's another section of the record where Attorney Jacobs, who is the village attorney, and he's sitting there with that aura of legal authority about him, says, what the state has told the assessor is that because of the court order, it should be classified as residential other than it is used. Is that your position, assessor? And the assessor says, exactly. And I put it to you that this is a citizen board, as Your Honor Gableman pointed out in the decision that overruled Act 86. And what we have here is a situation where there was an error of law. Pure and simple, there was an error of law. And the most, I believe not that it matters anything. I think it should go back to, I think the fairest thing would be to have it go back to the Board of Review for further proceedings, which is something that is allowed under the law.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you all for very good briefs and for interesting arguments, and you, Attorney Stroud, for something that I hadn't seen before since I've been here. We appreciate all of your assistance. The arguments were very good and very interesting. We're going to break for lunch now. We will be back at 1:30 for our third argument of the day. We are adjourned.